Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to the second debate. Very exciting. My name is Susan Phillip with the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and I'm incredibly happy to be moderating this debate, an incredibly important question, one that is so relevant to work in many of the areas of the country where we're actually doing program work related to decreasing morbidity in MSM. And I know we think about this a lot in San Francisco, where we've just seen our rate of new HIV diagnoses drop to an all-time low since the start of the epidemic, while our rates of STDs and MSM are going up. So the question before us is this one. Is it okay if MSM get STIs, just not HIV? So Bill did the hard work for me, so go to your app and find the second debate, open it up, and the vote is there, phrased just as this question. And we can see what the audience votes. I'll give you all a second to vote. Okay, let's see. Here we go. Okay, so yes is the losing vote at this point. Yes, it's okay, and no is winning with 81%. So with that in mind, I'm going to introduce our two speakers. We have very illustrious discussants today to speak about this. Going first, taking the yes side, and with his work cut out for him, is Dr. Mike Cohen. And for both of our speakers, I'm going to greatly abbreviate their CVs just for the sake of time. But Dr. Mike Cohen is the Jürgen Bate Eminent Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, and Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the director of the UNC Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases. He'll be taking the yes position and going first. And then arguing against this motion is Dr. Laura Bachman, a professor of medicine at Wake Forest University Health Sciences and medical director at Guilford County Department of Health and Human Services.
Good afternoon, or almost good evening. Thanks for being here. As was indicated, I'm an enormous underdog in this. In fact, I can't believe 18% of people voted for this. And so I will consider, if it was 18.3, was that what it was? If it remains 8.3, this is a huge victory. A huge victory. So my work is to not lose votes. It's not to gain additional votes. Because the people in this audience are STI experts. You are not going to vote to ignore STIs. It's impossible. This is not a meeting where that's even vaguely possible, and you're not going to vote to leave STIs alone. So under these conditions, how can I possibly gain an additional vote? Well, in preparation for this, I watched thousands of hours of Fox News. And in that context, I'm somewhat demented and more aggressive, and the number one thing is to attack my opponent. So is she really healthy enough for this debate? When she comes to the podium, a single cough should end this debate, in my opinion. Any sign of weakness would end the debate. So in preparation to attack her, then I started to look at her dogs and her family. Well, okay. So let me explain. Here's where the problem goes with this whole idea. This is the world's most perfect American family. The wreath on the door, the beautiful children, the perfect husband, and the three, and she confused me because she has Dachshunds and Corgis, and these are her Dachshunds, is that correct? And the Dachshunds are smarter than the Corgis. The Corgis are 11th smartest dog, and that was going to be a big part of this debate. Who would buy an 11th smartest dog? But since she's only showing the Dachshunds, we won't go there. The other problem is she and her husband were both our students at UNC, so it makes me a little... I saw that Jono and Matt went for each other's throats. It was brutal. I won't be able to do that. So under those circumstances, again, getting back to Fox News, let's just redefine the question. There is no reason for you to pursue the question, the kind of stupid question that was asked. Instead, we're going to answer different questions. STIs, and I'm going to, the affirmative here is that STIs can be acquired without compromising strategies to prevent HIV, and of course it is not okay, it's not okay to get an STI, the false premise that this organization put forth. However, it is okay to get an STI and still expect to avoid HIV under the right circumstances. That's what you're voting on, and I intend a huge increase in support. So we're going to cover real quickly two ideas. ART prevents HIV transmission, treatment is prevention, and the STIs have no effect. And the TDF-FTC, the only available pre-exposure prophylaxis, also known as Truvada, prevents acquisition in MSM, who we're focusing on, and the STIs that they acquire in the context of PrEP will have no effect on the activity of the PrEP. That's what you're going to vote on. So let's first deal with me. Let's talk about what wind up being narcissistic. Here's a recently published article dealing with treatment as prevention that demonstrates in 10,000 person years where we treated people with ART, hundreds of whom acquired HIV, STDs or STIs during the course of the study. There were no transmission events when people were suppressed. So the STIs acquired while people were treated did not overwhelm the treatment. And this is supported by what I think is a pretty good meta-analysis looking at viral load in people with HIV who get an STI. And the point was that the viral load did not go up enough to promote a transmission event, since viral load explains a transmission event. So I think we can dismiss the idea that if you're treated and you get an STI, you somehow are compromised in the prevention benefits of the treatment. But let's go to what I think for this meeting is a more critical issue, and that is TDF-FTC for PrEP, which is a very popular topic at this meeting, for prevention of acquisition of HIV. Approved in July of 2012 by the FDA, it's our only approved drug. And this slide, a complicated slide, but demonstrates what I think most people know. I don't have a pointer, or maybe I do, but I think what this slide demonstrates is that adherence to TDF-FTC is tightly related to the prevention benefit, and it's generally accepted, especially in MSM, that good adherence leads to good prevention benefit, perhaps as high as 85-90%, or maybe even higher with perfect adherence. But I want to go to a different point of view. I want to go to a study called IPERGAY, and in this study with IPERGAY, they decided to use TDF-FTC not on a daily basis, as is approved in the United States, but to use it intermittently with two pills before sexual exposure, a pill the day after, and a pill the next day. These four pills were used then to prevent HIV acquisition. And here's the issue. So they did a double-blind, randomized controlled trial, which demonstrated really good prevention of HIV acquisition, but then they extended the trial to open label. What I want to show you on this slide, and it's in detail, is that the participants of this study had a tremendous incidence of STIs. You'll see that the incidence in the randomized controlled trial was 35 per 100 person years, and when they extended the study and people knew that the TDF-FTC was going to prevent HIV, the incidence of new STIs was 40 per 100 person years, and the STIs they acquired are shown in the slide. Why is this really important to what I want you to vote on? Because when we look at the incidence of HIV in the study, you look at on the right-hand side, in the placebo group, 6.6 per 100 person years. Then the TDF-FTC in the double-blind study, in spite of the STIs, lowered HIV acquisition dramatically, significantly. And then what's really important is when there were more STIs in the open-label study, you got down to 0.19 per 100 person years incidence of HIV. So, and the overall protection from the study was 97% in spite of all the STIs. So I think this is very compelling evidence that the STIs that occur and that are going to be inevitable in this space, they do not overwhelm the benefit ART in MSM. This is further informed by a study from the West Coast using the whole Kaiser Permanente system by Jonathan Volk, published in CID pretty recently. And I just want to go slowly over his data. He studied 657 MSM who used TDF-FTC for PrEP, and I want you to see that unfortunately, but as it were, 30% of the PrEP users acquired an STI in the first 6 months, and unfortunately, but as it were, 50% of the PrEP users acquired an STI in 12 months, and the STIs are summarized on the slide, but in 338 years of person years follow-up, there were no acquisitions of HIV. Now, of course, we're not controlling exposure, but they're living in cities where exposure would be expected, and the lack of HIV in this setting strongly suggests that STIs will not overwhelm the benefits of PrEP. Now, if this weren't enough, let's once again attack the CDC, which is what any ivory tower guy does. And it's not really an attack, it's just a point. The CDC in 2014, confronted with TDF-FTC in 2012, labored over guidelines to manage pre-exposure prophylaxis. So they published their guidelines in 2014. They have 67 pages of guidelines. 67 pages. That's 60,000 or more words. There are 17 words devoted to STIs. Measure them every 6 months and then forget about it. So my only point is, de facto, the CDC has accepted the fact that acquisition of STIs is not a central concern to TDF-FTC usage for PrEP in the United States. That's how I interpret 17 over 80,000 or 17 words in 67 pages. Now, if none of this is enough to just move 2% of you to a different direction, HIV costs a lot. STIs are much cheaper. And so if you acquire HIV at age 35, it costs $326,000 just for your management over a lifetime. And then that doesn't take into consideration other people you might infect with HIV. So it's a hugely different cost of preventing HIV and preventing an STI. So in summary, the real debate resolution, I want you to ignore whatever you heard from the organizers of this meeting. Here's what you're really voting on. Of course it's not okay for MSMs to get STIs. But if STIs are an inevitable part of PrEP, deployment, they will not compromise the benefits of the ART. It is simply not reasonable to withhold TDF-FTC PrEP because people who use PrEP get STIs, as my opponent will undoubtedly argue, unsuccessfully, I might add. So you are voting on my resolution, and this is the resolution that you are voting on. Ignore whatever Sevgiral and others told you. It is okay to get an STI and expect that you will not get HIV if ARVs have been properly deployed. Thank you.
So, thank you, Mike. I guess I should not be surprised that you took an HIV-centric view here with your argument and have the ego to change the question we're voting on today. All right, so before I get started on debunking some of his argument, and some of it we'll deal with in the rebuttal, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about our HIV superstar here, our HIV research superstar, and give you some background. He's already told you, but I'm going to take a trip down memory lane. And that's when I first met Mike Cohen in microbiology in the first year of medical school at Chapel Hill, where he piqued my interest in STDs. And then I went on to do my first clinical research project with his wife, the noted medical sociologist Gail Henderson, and Dr. Leone in an STD clinic before moving on to UAB and working with Ned Hook for 14 years. So this man actually got me started in some ways on my path to study STDs. But that's back when Dr. Cohen did STD research. And at that time, I could not think about Mike Cohen without thinking about ejaculate. Okay, so it's like I could not think about one thing without the other, okay? But that was before he went to the dark side. I don't know if I can make this work. It's not going to work. So we're going to move on. Now, why did he move to the dark side? Perhaps money, I guess. In STDs, we have a history of being poorly funded, so maybe he just followed the money here. And he looks quite smug here, and he should, because he's accomplished quite a lot. But I would posit that part of the reason we're here today having this argument or debate is because of the unintended consequences of his body of research. All right, so I'm going to remind him of what he taught me, and that is that STIs have a negative impact at the molecular and cellular level. And I apologize for some of you, this is going to be very basic, but we know, not everyone is going to be able to be on PrEP, right, unfortunately. So we know that STIs play a significant role here through the disruption of epithelial mucosal barriers, whether they be microscopic or macroscopic defects. These STIs increase the number of HIV target cells in the genital tract, the expression of HIV co-receptors on these cells, and induce cytokines that then increase HIV shedding if that individual is HIV infected at that time. HIV also alters the natural history of STIs. And I would say Dr. Cohen and his getting to the ejaculate thing And why I associate that so much with him is some elegant studies that he and his group performed in Malawi, where they studied the HIV RNA levels in men who had urethritis, gonococcal urethritis, or no urethritis. And you can see a picture's worth a thousand words, the differences in that viral shedding with the STIs present. And then despite the fact that these were bacterial STIs largely and respond to treatment, you can see that the treatment levels decreased, but then it took a while to get to baseline. So gonorrhea, for instance, is the gift that keeps on giving here. While the bug is easily treated, the inflammatory response is more difficult to ratchet back. My other point is that STIs are harmful to the individual. So HPV is common, practically a rite of passage. But I don't want to dismiss this, and I say this on behalf of my patients, because not everyone has HPV that's easily managed. Perianal high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions, for instance, are related to HPV. And we are seeing squamous cell carcinoma now of the anus, and with rates of about 70 to 100 per 100,000 population in HIV-positive MSM. To give you an idea of how that compares to cervical cancer, before the Pap smear, the rates were 35 per 100,000. So that's an emerging issue that we need to deal with. Gonococcal infections usually are more straightforward, but disseminated gonococcal infections, symptomatic gonococcal or chlamydial proctitis can lead to hospitalizations, especially with proctitis. If you run across a provider that does not have that on the differential, people get CAT scans, IV antibiotics, they're admitted to the hospital, they undergo colonoscopies. There's also, this is more difficult to measure, but there is psychological morbidity associated with STIs, and herpes is probably the best related to this. And you can see this article title from the mid-80s where genital herpes was called a pervasive psychosocial disorder. Now, I would not go that far, but those of us who take care of patients know that a certain proportion of them have a struggle with this diagnosis, likely related to the way our society views STIs and herpes as reflected in this negative Time magazine cover. The next point is that the bugs, unfortunately, I hate to be a glass half empty kind of gal, but the bugs are going to outsmart us, and if we don't think that otherwise, we've got our head in the sand. So even the lay press is aware of our gonococcal resistance problem, and this was manifested in the New Yorker article in 2012. And then in June of this year, the first report of dual antimicrobial therapy failure for the treatment of gonococcal infection in the UK using doses of ceftriaxone that are actually twice what we use here in the States. And then from our own GIST surveillance network, some concerning findings here where seven individuals were found to have isolates with high level azithromycin resistance and compromised ceftriaxone MICs. Now, fortunately, there were no treatment failures associated with this, but we know that that may be a matter of time. And then resistance is not only relevant for gonococcal infection. HSV can become resistant, particularly in individuals who have HIV. And the gentleman there on the right actually was on hemodialysis due to toxic medications required to control his herpes infection. So I would say STDs in and of themselves are significant when you take HIV out of it. STIs may be doing new and different things, but there's also new bugs. And many of you guys heard today about Ebola and Zika. And then we know that hepatitis C is a concern for men who have sex with men, especially HIV-infected MSM. And the final point, and the most important point that I want to make today, is that STIs are not okay because it's really not consistent with sexual health. To recurrent STIs, even when they're uncomplicated, resulting in multiple exposures to antibiotics, et cetera, is really not consistent. And sexual health of the MSM community is very important. I don't think it'd be really acceptable to accept this question in any other population in the United States. I want to remind people of sexual health. Dr. Hook covered some of this today, but it's not just about physical health. It also includes emotional, mental, social, and spiritual dimensions. And while one of the goals is prevention of disease and other adverse outcomes of disease, it's broader than that, and I would urge us to keep our focus actually broad. There's a lot of reasons for these the disparities in STI prevalence in MSM, and some of them are behavioral, but we know this population is heterogeneous and not everyone is practicing risk behavior. There's differences in networks, there's physiologic factors that are in play, developmental and psychological factors, and then a higher prevalence of alcohol and drug use in the context of sex. So I'm going to end with this statement from my colleague, Dr. Valdeseri, who says that successful efforts to reduce STD disparities amongst MSM need to promote healthy, safe, and fulfilled persons, not just disease-free genital tracts. So while this particular debate focuses on the genital tract, I think the overarching goal should be sexual health, and it's time to end this stigmatizing association between MSM sexuality and disease. So I rest my case.
I will be very brief because I think Laura did an excellent job at arguing what is essentially not mutable. That is, it can't possibly be okay to get STIs. But I don't think that really can be argued. But I actually, in a more serious vein, I really do think that the community of HIV STI providers are confronted with what I wanted to talk about, as you point, the ego to change the topic. So I do think that the issue that's going to confront the providers and clinics that are increasingly going to be providing pre-exposure prophylaxis are that they're going to confront condomless sex and more STIs. And so the question that I tried to raise, in spite of the real question asked, I think is important, and it came up in Jono's lection as well, Jono and Matt's discussion as well, because they're talking about missed opportunities to test and get people into care or into better prevention activities for HIV. So I think there's no real rebuttal. It's not okay to get STIs, and STIs have consequences, but they are not greater than HIV, and this kind of marriage that's going to have to take place in the STI clinics as they move to be more and more HIV providers. The biggest applause I heard today were for STI clinics that were providing PrEP very aggressively currently. So I think that my rebuttal just brings me back to my wanting to talk about a question that was not the question asked, which I will continue to do from here on forth. Thank you.
So I agree that providers that are providing PrEP are going to see a lot of STIs. I would urge us not to give up on that. I still argue and that the STIs are significant in and of themselves. The number of times that, this is anecdotal, but that I've had, say, a patient trap me in the room because they fell out over their HSV diagnosis when they already had HIV, it is not trivial. And so those sorts of things have impact. As providers, you know, seeing a lot of STIs coming in the clinic door, sometimes we can be a little fatalistic, but I want to encourage providers to work with patients. And we know that we have a history of time-limited. It doesn't require a lot of time for providers to work with patients around change and behavioral change and staying healthy. So I'm not against PrEP at all. My hopes are that as we continue to roll out PrEP, we'll start working to also decrease those other STIs because they are important. That's going to require working with our patients and also adapting things in our clinic to you know, different techniques to get extragenital testing performed quickly and efficiently. And I've got lots of colleagues who've worked on that successfully. So I don't want to be totally pessimistic about the future with the STI prevalence and PrEP. Even if it's not going to impact the HIV prevention angle, I think in and of itself we need to work to diminish, you know, to decrease the prevalence in the population. But we've got to work with the community, obviously. The community has to have concerns and weigh in with that, too.
Okay, we just have a few minutes, maybe 3 minutes, for one or two comments, and we'll start with Sevgi.
This is not a comment on this debate. I am Sevgi Arav, and on behalf of the Scientific Program Committee, I would like to thank all four debaters hugely. Each one of them was assigned the arguments they have presented to you. None of them volunteered for the position they have taken. Dr. Mike Cohen, of course, we know him well, we love him because of this, announced to you that he was assigned the argument position. None of the other three did so. All four of them were assigned their positions, and we are, as the Scientific Program Committee, really indebted to them for having accepted doing that. Thank you all very much.
One more comment here, and please state your name. Where
Sheena
you're from.
McCormack from London. So, Mike, I cannot believe you didn't use the randomized evidence from PROUD showing that it makes no difference to STIs if you have the group with PrEP and the group compared to no PrEP. That is the one study that shows you in the real world that it doesn't make a difference to the STIs.
You gave a talk yesterday. The reason I
did
that, you gave a whole hour talk. It was a wonderful talk, so I decided to spread the spread the recognition to the French.
But it is definitely... I'm glad you did that. I'm really glad you did that. Because
the British had an hour yesterday, so here's...
we're not doing quite so well with our breakthrough infections, unfortunately.
Plus there's Brexit.
But it is not okay.
You have to defend Brexit.
But it is not okay to get STIs, and I really welcome the messages I've heard today in several of the sessions, but actually in Matt's talk this morning about this need to look on the broader picture of sexual health for gay men. It's so important, and what I love about PrEP is it really opens up that dialogue about happy sex, pleasurable sex, and a really proper, decent conversation in clinic that will allow us, I think, to make real inroads in that direction and get control of the other STI.
Thank you. So I know that we said that we would do a closing poll, but there's been a mini revolt, and Dr. Cohen says we have to vote on his question if we're going to vote.
Or no vote.
So I think we'll end it there then. Thank you.
Excuse me, the session is not over, so if you're interested now in hearing from practical applications about what we just heard, we have invited a group to kind of offer their own perspective as members of the MSM in their communities or providers who are currently working with MSM. So we invite you to stay for the last part. Okay, we're going to start with the last part of the session. In this session, we have invited two members of the MSM community in the areas where they live, and we have invited a provider who currently works with MSM in his community. Everybody's leaving. Okay, let's move quickly. Okay, our first speaker in this session is Dr. Leandro Mena. Dr. Mena is a professor in the School of Medicine at the University of Mississippi, and he currently is the medical director of two clinics in Jackson, Mississippi. One is the STD clinic in the Public Health Department, and the other one is a primary care clinic with a focus on LGBT. Our second speaker is Daniel Driffin, and he's the co-founder of Thrive SS, Inc., it is a nonprofit organization that is helping black, gay, bisexual, and same-gender loving men achieve vital suppression. Thrive SS manages a social support system with 550 black men living with HIV. He's currently attending the medical school at Morehouse School of Medicine here in Atlanta. And our last speaker here is Jason McCarty. He's a branding and corporate image consultant specializing in customer retention. He's a graduate of Stern Business School in New York University, and he's currently living in Jackson, Mississippi with his Shih Tzu, Bella. And we have a skewed presentation here because all three are coming from the South, but I think MSM are experiencing big challenges in the South, so I think we deserve to hear what they have to say. Let's welcome them.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Raul, for the introduction, and thank you for the committee inviting us to be part of this presentation. I want to start by, you know, really thanking, you know, the conference, you know, committed for, you know, having this conversation about important issues in STD control involving gay, bisexual men and other men versus men that very often are left out. And I think, you know, how to manage the STD epidemic that exists in MSM is an important health issue that we have to think about. But we don't have, you know, as it was discussed, you know, a lot of data. But we have to figure out, you know, what we're going to do, how we're going to approach this. I have to say that I agree with all the presenters. They all made, you know, very important points that need to be considered. And I think the key issue, you know, I work in two different clinics in the South. One is a public health clinic. The other one is a primary care clinic. And those clinics see different kinds of patients, right? So in a public health clinic setting, expedited partner therapy can present some challenges. And some of these challenges is the fact that we have to understand that gay and bisexual men are a population in our country that have, you know, are affected by huge health disparities. And perhaps we shouldn't miss out on the opportunity to bring these men to health services so we can screen them for these health disparities, so we can address, you know, some of these other comorbidities that may affect them, and not less than all of them HIV infections. So in places like Jackson, Mississippi, where the HIV prevalence is so high, as a healthcare provider, as a public health practitioner, I wouldn't want to miss a single opportunity to get, you know, one of these men to our clinic so we can do a more thorough assessment. At the same time, a lot has been talked about pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it's possible that sexual partners of individuals who are taking pre-exposure prophylaxis that may be a lower risk of getting HIV, at least from that partner, or people who are being screened for STDs and tested, you know, found in with sexually transmitted infections in the context of primary care, who may have a smaller number of partners, who may know who their partners are, then, you know, some aspects of a partner delivered treatment may be more effective and applicable. So I think, you know, all the things that have been said here are a great opportunity for us to reflect and to think about in our setting, you know, which strategies may work best and to which populations some of these things, you know, may be applicable, may work. And I think that's all I have to say.
I feel the same way, especially as a person living with HIV and a person connected to people at risk for HIV. We truly have to create additional ways to promote synergy. So the fact for someone at risk for HIV, they have to be tested for sexually transmitted infections. I mean, we are less than a mile away from the county health department here, and we see, you know, rectal gonorrhea and chlamydia cases, and especially syphilis. Like we say on the street, it's easier to find syphilis in Atlanta than a free ham sandwich. So we really have to pair testing together for everyone, not just people at risk for HIV, but people living with HIV as well.
First, thank you for having me. I was asked to come as an outside perspective, not from a medical. So I came in this with a kind of an open mind, not really doing my due diligence before, because I wanted to hear both sides without. Going into this, I didn't know I would have a personal experience with it until I heard it. But I grew up in Mississippi. I moved to New York to go to NYU. I lived in Seattle as I was doing a consulting assignment, and then I moved back to Mississippi. In Seattle, while there, I was dating someone that actually did come home and tell me that he had chlamydia. And hearing the argument, I remember that so powerful that it was 7 o'clock at night, because he worked. He went to the clinic. Of course, he neglected, you know, to come home. He was nervous. And I just remembered thinking that, oh my God, the clinics are closed. Do I have it? Is it possible? Did he give it to me? Did he cheat on me? You know, did he get it from me? And just to think that there is a possible opportunity that he could have came home and said, you know what, I care so much about you that I have this prescription for you, let's go get this filled. That would have saved such a void of a restless night. It was a very restless night. I was worried. I didn't know if I had it. I didn't know what time I could get to the clinic. I'm literally set the alarm early where I could set the first appointment. And so I see both sides of the argument, but from a personal experience, just to know if we could just be more, if we take the more emotional side of it and get the clinical side out of it, that if we have an opportunity that we were diagnosed with something and we could right then get a prescription to take home to the person that we love, that's pretty powerful. And it just kind of just would have just saved a lot of emotional stress in my mind for the rest of the evening. I also want you to think that majority of the people that are in committed relationships, now granted there are people that have multiple partners, and that's something else we have to think about and address, but people that are in committed relationships, when their partner comes home and says that they have something, they take it very seriously. And they are going to go to the clinic. I couldn't wait till the alarm went off to go to the clinic to get the extra things. And, of course, then is when we did the extra screenings for everything else. So I think it's important to look past, oh, is it important for these two characteristics or these two diseases? But let's get more emotional about it and think, you know what? Even if I didn't have it, which I didn't, even if I didn't have it, the pill wouldn't kill me. You know, I could take it. It could be a bonding experience to go to the pharmacy together to get this prescription, you know. And also, like, it might make the partner more willing to actually tell them that they actually do have something because they have a outcome with it. You know, if they could say, I have this for you, you know, even if it wasn't a committed relationship, even if it was someone that they, you know, had sex with a couple of times a week or maybe once, that they could pick up the phone and say, you know what, I like you so much as a friend. I just got diagnosed with this. I would really appreciate if you want this prescription, I have it for you, or I can get it for you. Then it really opens up a really honest dialogue in comparison to, well, I just got this, and good luck, go to the health department, that's where I just went. You know, I just feel it's kind of full circle. To the second conversation, you know, again, when I agreed to do this, I didn't know that it would hit emotionally and personally. But I remember my best friend, actually also in Seattle, sorry, nothing against both scenarios being in Seattle, great place. But he had a doctor that he went to, and this was back when Truvada was first coming out. It was, you know, mainstream, but it was a lot of, some physicians didn't know if it was safe, or if they didn't know enough about it that they felt comfortable writing prescriptions. And I remember him saying that his doctor, you know, he went, because we had talked about it, like, oh, should we get on this? It's a big deal. Should we do it? And I remember him telling me that his doctor said, you know, she didn't know enough about it, so she didn't write the prescription. She didn't feel comfortable yet writing the prescription. And then I remember 6 months later sitting in the room with him, with the same doctor, because he got a phone call to come immediately to bring a friend. And that same doctor told him that he had HIV. And I remember looking on that doctor's face, and you could really tell she was hurt by it, that she had to tell the same patient 6 months prior that she didn't believe it, or not necessarily believe it, but she didn't know enough research about it, that now he has HIV. That was a very powerful moment to watch that. I'd never seen a doctor hug a patient like that. I'd never seen a doctor really get emotional. Because that doctor said, you were one of my best patients. You were always very careful. I'm sorry that I didn't write that prescription. So that was a powerful moment. You know, and since I have a mic in front of me, and if it's okay, to go even further, kind of some discussion with the CDC, because I am a branding and marketing person, and I look at things in that way. I also remember being with him the next day when he got the phone call from the health department. And I think we also need to think past the initial getting the diagnosis, but how we can better speak with people that just got that information not even 24 hours late before. You know, I know as a medical profession, your job is to stop the risk, you know, get it done, let's, as many partners as we can, let's tell everyone. But just like, you know, someone that may have got diagnosed with cancer or something else, you have to be a little bit more compassionate. And I just remember him hanging up the phone and saying, I just felt like I'd just been prosecuted for a crime. You know, I really feel like that they just said to me, I need the last six people you slept with, we're going to call them, blah, blah, blah. You know, so with that comment said, I think that we should really also be considering and talking about better bedside manners with the people on the phone, better bedside manners with the researchers that actually do the conversations. And if I also may, you know, I've looked at a lot of literature before coming to the convention. I didn't look at the two topics because I wanted to come with an open mind. But I think that we need a lot more foreign publications. I'm not seeing a lot of things in foreign languages. A lot, I'm sure they're out there. Lastly, I sat on a session on the criminalization issue, and we have got to work with local, state, and higher officials to get better laws for people to protect them that have this disease. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, everyone. This concludes this session, and thank you to the three participants. Thank you.